And now, the Hard Foul Sports Cleveland Podcast. Here are your hosts, Mike Tolsma, Adam Bennett, and Mike Arnold. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that sound means that it is time for our first ever guest here on the Hard Foul Sports Cleveland Podcast. And our first guest, when it's all said and done, will wind up probably being the best guest that we ever have on this podcast. You can hear him in the mornings on 92.3 The Fan with Kevin Kiley. You can hear him all across the Cleveland Browns radio network. You can hear him nationally on Sunday nights on CBS Sports Radio. He is, far and away, the best sports radio talk show host in the city of Cleveland. And most importantly, he is the president of the local chapter of the Florida Georgia Line Fan Club. It is Ken Carman. Ken, thank you for joining us today.
I hate that band more than cancer.
We're off to a good start.
Thank you very much.
Oh.
That's a very subjective thing you said, by the way. I had a guy call me a fat donut on Sunday. So not everybody agrees with you, but you know, I thank you.
Well, listen, I feel like I have to say something nice about you because, you know, we've known each other now for 4 or 5 years, and we follow each other on Twitter. And people in Cleveland who follow both me and you probably think that we absolutely hate each other by the way that we tweet, but it's all in good fun.
Yeah. You had a bunch of people, and they're like, why is Ken Carman being such a D to you? I'm like, I'm not, no, you don't get it. Like, no, that's not how, I wouldn't, if I didn't know you, I wouldn't be like that. At least I wouldn't try.
I'll tell you what, we have a lot of fun. We can joke around, and it's actually nice, it's nice to be talking to you, not as, you know, a fake football coach in the National Football League, and actually, you know, to have a good conversation.
I didn't even know, because first of all, I see some tweet, like a couple, when was this, like a few weeks ago, like, really, you're doing this, Ken? You've stooped to a new low. I'm like, who the hell is this guy trying to troll me? And I said, I didn't even think about this. This is on my co-host. Not that I'm trying to throw him under the bus, but I guess I will. I didn't mean to do it like that. But I'm sitting there going, well, what the hell? Why am I getting this type of stuff? And then I find out it's you who's saying it, which you should have known better than I wouldn't think about. God knows I wouldn't think about what he thought of that day, which I don't even remember what it was.
Yeah, I don't either. It's just we like to make fun of each other. That's the common theme of the relationship between me and Ken. And it goes back to the Pat Shurmur days, and so that's a good lead-in to the Cleveland Browns, Ken. And, you know, we've talked on these podcasts. This is our third episode now, and it's been a common theme throughout. We suck on defense. We're garbage on defense. Our offensive line isn't as good as everybody says it is or should be. We're devoid of talent. But that theme kind of rings through this week, and even though we won on the road at Baltimore, all of a sudden, Josh McCown, who, listen, I railed on Mike Pettine, and a lot of people railed on Mike Pettine for sticking with Josh McCown. He looks like the reincarnation of Peyton Manning in his prime, and he's winning us games by, like, throwing it 50 times and completing 70% of his passes. So my question to you is, can the Browns sustain this on offense if they are going to be this bad on defense? And is Josh McCown, like, is he the real deal and we've missed out on it for 15 years now?
I mean, he's had up and down. So this is the reason why guys did go out and say, this is why there was a market for him. Is I was really upset, and I like what you asked there, but I was really upset, too, when they went after him. I was really upset. I felt to me like they were punting the season in January, for crying out loud. But, you know, this is kind of why, because there's something to Josh. And it's to me, it's what makes Josh great at times, and I think this will also be the downfall, you know, is that for him, there's still a chase. If you're into it 13 years, there's got to be something where you're still trying to go on to that dream. This is why I used to get so upset with people when we'd start screaming and yelling about Seneca Wallace. And this was with Colt McCoy. This is years ago. That's how far back I'm drawn. Is that people used to get so angry with Seneca Wallace because he didn't want to be a backup. And I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of guys who don't want to be a backup. There's a lot of backups, career backups, where they accept their role. They know what they're doing, but they want that shot. They want that chance. And I was always okay with Seneca Wallace thinking he could play quarterback in the NFL. I disagreed with him, but I was okay with him thinking that. You have to have a guy who has confidence. And for Josh, he looks the part. You know what I mean? Like, he's 6'4", he's strong arm, he can throw a pretty decent deep ball. I think his deep ball's better than what we want to give him credit for.
Yeah.
He can throw a pretty decent one. He's smart. He can work on defenses. He knows the plays. He knows what type of offenses you're trying to work with. He can take what's given to him. But there are times where he gets a little overzealous and he'll make dumb mistakes. He'll make stupid mistakes like he did at the end of regulation when he didn't throw the ball away and let it run down from 14 to 6 seconds, which took a play away from them. There was the stupidity that ended up getting called back on a roughing the passer penalty, which that was an interception, which he should have either thrown away or maybe taking a sack or anything, but what he did, he's still capable of doing that. And I think that's part of the chase that he has, is that he's just such an odd duck that there is some talent in there. There really is some talent in there with Josh McCown, and I've grown to admire him for his honesty, knowing what the situation is, knowing that people want to see Johnny Manziel, and being able to deal with that, being able to deal with some of the adversity that he's already dealt with, and being able to really respond and play well. I've actually grown to admire the man in that way, because I was not a fan. I was upset when they signed him, really upset when they signed him. I wanted them, I could see their reasoning in starting him again after Johnny, but I disagreed with it. I thought that you try to get it to trend upwards. But what he's doing is he's showing us, one, what it is like to have a franchise quarterback, at least for a day. That felt like a franchise. That was a franchise performance. Josh isn't a franchise quarterback, but that was a franchise performance. That was a great day and a really a great win for them. I don't think we're making a big enough deal about how big of a win that really was and the moment, the enjoyment of what that win was. Another thing of what he's doing is that he's making Pettine an argument here. I think that we were so upset and we're thinking, God, this is really the first move that a lot of people really disagree with Mike Pettine on. And then they go out and they lose like that to Oakland, and my God, it looks terrible. Then he has a good game against San Diego. They still lose, and it just seems like it's mounting up. And you hear what's going on with Joe Hayden. You hear what's going on with some of the other guys in the locker room, and they have to defend Joe Hayden. And then it changes after they beat Baltimore on the road, because that's what a franchise quarterback will do. That's a franchise performance. They can cover up problems. When they win, they cover up problems with the team. They cover up problems with the organization. They cover things up. That's what Andrew Luck does. That's what Tom Brady has done. That's what Peyton Manning has certainly done in his career. These guys do that. And that was one performance. I don't think he's going to... He might have a few more. I don't think we're taking off, and he is an actual franchise quarterback. But that was so big for him, and I think that really gives legitimacy to Pettine's decision of, we're trying to win games. This guy puts us in the right position to win games. I don't care what you say. I got to win games. I can't trust what the owner says, and I wouldn't either. I have to put our best foot forward, and I have to put this thing in the hands of Josh McCown until it is time where I can not give up on the season, but I can make it okay and say, all right, fine, we'll turn it over to Johnny. But I think Josh McCown has been splendid. It's been certainly a bit of a surprise. I think he surprised himself, and it was fun to watch on Sunday. I really enjoyed him.
Well, here's the thing, and we've seen an experience.
I thought we were going to be on camera, by the way, so I brought a High Life, and now I'm just going to drink it.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. You should see Ken. We're doing this over Skype, by the way. And first of all, thank goodness.
Well, no, don't tell anybody, because I feel like I've ruined it. I don't want to give away what we could sell someday.
That's true, but all I was going to say is thank goodness for your wife. To get you connected into Skype.
Wasn't that great? Her reaching over going, Ken, this is what you do? And I'm looking at it like, oh.
Okay. Oh, man.
Like, you know what that is? That's Fat Kevin in 40 years. That's what that is.
Well,
that's what I was.
Listen,
like,
you...
Well, what's you, that? Like, God, it's terrible.
You brought up some really good points about McCown. Here's the thing that I can't understand and I can't wrap my mind around is, look, we've seen a lot of really weird things as Browns fans, but... You know, we were fed from the GM to the coaching staff, everybody in the organization, hey, we're not going to be that good on offense. We know it. We understand it. We're going to play really good defense, and we're going to play ball control offense, and we're going to run it up and down the field. And, you know, take some clock away and be really smart about it. And so, to me, I think that's part of the reason why a lot of fans had a problem with Mike Pettine's decision, because after hearing all of that, I'm sitting here and I'm saying, wait a minute, Johnny Manziel played a really good game against Tennessee. He's proven that he can be that clock manager guy if you ask him to, that he can control the game, be the game managing quarterback, all of those things. So why would you turn to the 36-year-old who's been on seven different teams just to do that? Yeah. And, you know, what I can't understand is, obviously, that's not how we're playing at all. Now, number one, I give Mike Pettine a lot of credit because he's not stubborn enough on the offensive side of the ball to say, hey, we need to do what it takes to win. So if it takes 50 throws in a game to win, we're going to do it. And Baltimore, there's no doubt about the fact that they were daring us to beat them with the pass, and we did. But at the same time, I want to get your thoughts about the defense and of Pettine in general, because, look, this is a defense that it has major problems, and we know that. But really, if you go back in Mike Pettine's career, since he left the shadow of Rex Ryan in New York, he went to Buffalo for a year. They had really good personnel on defense. He finished 28th against the run. He comes here last year, and we had a decent to good defense, but we couldn't stop the run. We were dead last in the NFL. Now, we can't really stop anything. And I think part of the problem is that as flexible as he is on offense and his willingness to say, I don't care what we have to do to win, we're going to do it, I don't really see that on defense. They're sticking to the same scheme. It's all this press man stuff. And even if Joe Hayden gets torched 5 to 6 times because he's hurt or whatever, he's having a bad game, they're just going to leave him out on that island. There's no adjustments to be made. So I just want to get your thoughts on that. Do you have the same concerns with the defense? Obviously, we know McCown isn't going to be a 450-yard quarterback every game, but can the defense turn it around, or is this something that we've just kind of relegated ourselves to, hey, look, we're not very good, and we'll deal with it?
Well, I don't know if they actually have the I don't know if they have the personnel now. I wonder if it's a personnel problem, because you have a scheme, and people say, well, you know, can you run a 4-3? Well, if you watch them, and I'm sure you do, I'm not accusing you here when I say you, it's the proverbial, but if you really watch them, they're in a 3-4 over a lot. I mean, that's basically a 4-3.
Right, yep.
You know, they run something really close to a 4-3 there. So I think then it comes to personnel, and if it comes to personnel, then that falls on your general manager. I mean, there's no other way to say it. It falls on your general manager, and you've had a guy who... It's weird. I like him personally. I think he's an affable guy, but I don't think he's right now. He's just not cut out for this position. He's not making these right decisions. He's right in what he, at least I agree with him in what he wants to do. And that's the beauty of this, is that it's all ideas and it's all conversation, and people who are listening to this, they can tell me to pound sand. I do agree with him on his tenets of how to work this thing, of build inside out.
Yep.
You know, start inside, start at the important places, then get out to your wide receivers. But even that, he contradicts himself when you sign a guy like Dwayne Bowe, and now it's just this albatross hanging over your neck at $9 million guaranteed, where you have guys who you can barely throw to. And that's what made Josh's performance that much more impressive, is that he created weapons to throw to. Defensively, though, if I have a problem with personnel, if I've hung my hat on what are we going to do stopping the run, what we're going to do stopping the pass, we're going to be this defense, and then we're not that, that's personnel. That means that you're not seeing players right, you're not seeing what you think are going to be good players, maybe you're not signing certain players, and then there comes a point of, okay, and this is where it is shared with Mike Pettine now, what are you getting out of them? Are they motivated? Are they really doing their best? That is a sincere question. That's something that I think we'll figure out as time goes on here. And I did like how when their backs were against the wall, they came up with a couple of stops. But right now you're throwing darts at a board trying to get something to stick with that. Because I can put a little bit on the coaching staff. I could certainly put it on Jim O'Neill with scheme. And because he's a coach, it falls on him. He says it's execution. Well, if it's execution, then that's a personnel problem then. And then that goes back to your general manager on picking that talent. And there is gold in the hills on that defense. When I think Danny Shelton has been unfairly criticized in certain ways.
I think too.
People are expecting him to go in and be Brandon Williams from the get-go. He's not. I think he's learning. And there's a couple of times where He's going to have to get his dander up. He's going to have to get his wind up, and this season is going to be an eye-opening season. I think we will continue to complain about him and be critical of him throughout the rest of this year. I think next year is the year where he starts to make an impact. I know people don't want to hear that because, you know, Mo Wilkerson in New York and Sheldon Richardson, when he's not, you know, racing cars with 12-year-olds in the back, is very, very good at what he does, and he's been good since the get-go. So those guys make him look bad. Okay. Well, do they make him look bad, or do they make him behind the curve, or were those guys just that good? I think those guys have been just that good. For Danny, these are fixable problems. There's pad level, which I think he can fix. There's also staying square. I think at times he is honestly gung-ho to make a play. He's not being lazy. He's far from lazy. So that means you can work with that and you can fix that thing. As long as he's not lazy and loafing and taking plays off while he's out there, because they've had to rotate him in because he's got to get his wind. He's got to get to an NFL level. These guys are good, and he's learning that. But if he's still trying, I can work with that. That's technique. I can fix that. I think that Danny can be still I think he still is going to be very, very good in the future. But with a couple of those other pieces, I wonder, what exactly are you doing here? Do we expect too much out of Christian Kirksey? Do we expect too much out of Armani Bryan, even though that wasn't their pick? Are we holding Armani back? Should we use Armani in a different level? Should we ask more out of Paul Kruger, who had a great preseason and a great 2014 and really hasn't shown up for the most part in 2015 as far as getting after a quarterback? You know, these are questions that I still need to put on you as a general manager. And even with Paul, again, Paul's a guy who's from a different signing, a different regime. But these are still your players, and these are still your decisions to make. And if you're going to dump or add or whatever, it's still on you to try to get that done.
Do you notice a difference in this is just me being casual fan, being at the games in person, and you know, to me, I try to watch afterwards if I go to a game and reevaluate when normally all of me being pissed off wears off after losing a game, but I'm starting to notice in a game, which is something I don't normally notice. I always like to watch the offense, right? I mean, that's the fun part of football to watch. Well, defensively, I'm seeing instances this year, especially against Oakland. We went man-to-man when they had the ball at like the 10-yard line, and we covered one of their tallest, most athletic receivers with Christian Kirksey, man-to-man. And, you know, so I bring that up to ask, do you notice a difference in play calling or scheme defects this year, or, you know, lack of coaching that wasn't there last year? Because last year I was actually really impressed with Mike Pettine's defense, which I think it was his defense. He was splitting play calls with Jim O'Neill. He was obviously very involved and, as he says, too much involved with that side of the ball. Well, this year he goes to the offensive side. And by the way, I mean, this is not a reflection on Pettine or DeFilippo or anybody on offense, because I think they are getting tremendous, tremendous production out of guys that shouldn't be producing the way that they... I mean, Gary Barnidge, for goodness sakes, is like the leading tight end in the National Football League right now, just behind Rob Gronkowski. So defensively, the fact that Pettine's walked away a little bit from that side of the ball, are you noticing a difference in play calling with Jim O'Neill that was there from when Pettine called him?
I don't see as many. I don't see as many nickel blitzes.
No,
I know K-1 was a guy they sent a lot. They sent him a couple of times against Baltimore, but I haven't seen as many. I haven't seen as many blitzes out of the secondary as we've seen before. I thought that. I thought Mike likes to mix it up a little bit more and likes to throw some more creative stunts. Barkevious, there would be a couple of times on a few blitzes and a few times where he would kind of do a loop and come right down the A gap and go after a quarterback. I haven't seen that. And for Pettine, his defenses, he's never been able to stop the run. In Buffalo, he wasn't able to stop the run. However, a caller pointed this out to us last week. They were 28th at the end of his season in Buffalo, but they've always been able to rush the passer.
Yeah.
Last year, they were able to rush the passer. Paul Kruger had a nice season. A couple of other guys had a nice season. Dez had a nice season going for him until he was injured, and that comes from some of those stunts that you see, some of those around stunts that you see across the defensive line, a couple of nacho moves even out of a 3-4. I thought that they were able to do some things nicely, and Dez was able to benefit from that. They've always been able to get a pass rush, and this is why I still think that he's not as involved. I think he's still involved in some way. He's not as involved as what we hope he is. Because if he was, he'd be blitzing a whole lot more. At least that defense would look like it's blitzing a whole lot more. Well, I guess Jim needs to blitz a whole lot more because you're not getting a pass rush. And what it does is before, he wasn't stopping the run, and you could say, well, they're just going to come out and pound you out, and that's going to be the end of it. Yeah, that's true, but at least you can try to hold things off. You've been able to blitz in certain positions where it's worked. He did it in Buffalo. He did it last year in Cleveland, where if you get any sort of a lead, then teams have to try to pass to catch up. Then teams have to eventually try to test the air, and nothing's there for you because, one, you don't have a lot of time to throw, and two, your corners, and he's very particular about his corners, and this part of the Justin Gilbert fiasco does go on Mike Pettine, no matter what anybody wants to say, but still. The second thing is that your corners are very good, and your secondary is very good where it tries to take that away. So he's very good with even a 6-point lead or certainly a 14-point lead or something like that. He's very good in that. And I think that's where he's been strong, talking about Pettine, I think that's where he's been strong in the past. This defense, if you don't have a lead and they can line up and they can pound you out, they're going to do that.
Yeah.
And I thought that there were a couple of times where and I have to go back and look at some Baltimore stuff, but I thought there were a couple of times where they had really abandoned some things that they were doing that was working out well, and they were able. But when they got the football back there at the very end, there were a couple of runs by Forsett and Reed, I think his name is, the new kid or whatever the hell his name is. He broke through a couple of times. If you're not going to be able to stop it like that, you better be able to get yourself some sort of a lead on offense. That's where it makes his offense very important. So they can say, well, we're going to line up and we're going to run the football. Well, you better get a lead lining up and running the football. You better get at least a nice touchdown somewhere in there because you're going to have to, you should be blitzing more. You should be able to stop the run a little bit better. But if you're not, at least blitz and get caught with your pants down instead of just, well, we're going to go out there and we're just going to kind of play base defense and we're still going to get beat on the edge and we're going to get beat running the football through the middle. That bothers me. But I think the way you're trying to go about fixing that is, one, I'd still take a look at where the personnel is going into next year, because I don't think it gets fixed this season. I'd look at some of the personnel this season and see where they're going from there. And then some of the other stuff that I figure out, how do I use these guys better in my scheme? How do I use these guys better in a 3-4? Or if he wants to switch it to a 4-3, officially switch it to a 4-3, where they work from there.
And not only just scheme, and we'll move on from this, but also, you know, the play calling. Look, if Joe Haden is struggling, and we've had points this year where he's really struggled, it's time to roll some safety help over toward him a little bit. Every now and again, because even the best have poor games from time to time, and you can't just, you know, that's the thing that bothers me. The adjustments within the game, to me, aren't there from Jim O'Neill, and you can see it in Jim O'Neill's face. If there's one thing that I've gotten good at as a Browns fan now for 27 years of life, it's being able to read coaches during the press conferences, because we've seen them all. We've seen the coaches that are genuinely confident. We've seen the coaches that are totally bullshitting their way through it. We've seen the coaches that are thin-skinned, and I won't mention any names there. But Jim O'Neill in his press conference Thursday, I mean, he was so defensive and combative at any hint of him being an issue. And I understand he's a young coordinator in the National Football League, but there's some element where you've got to step up and say, hey, look, you know what? If I need to make changes, I've got to make changes. And I've got to be better at what I'm doing, and I've got to be better at calling plays, and instead of putting it on the players, because you and I both know, Ken, when veteran players like Tremont Williams and Paul Kruger openly criticize your play calling and say, hey, by the way, Phillip Rivers was calling out exactly what we were doing in the San Diego game, that's a problem, because veteran players don't just do that because of one bad game of play calling. They do that typically with coaches that they don't believe in or they think a serious change needs to be made. So, you know, we'll see how that works out, but I like Pettine. I like him a lot less than I did last year for a number of reasons this year, and he's got a long way to go.
But why is that?
You know, to be honest with you, a couple of things. I don't like his demeanor on the sidelines, and this is just a personal thing, but I had the opportunity to sit close to the sideline when we played at Buffalo last year. I've had the opportunity to do it twice this year, and I've spent a lot of the game just watching him. There's no in-game coaching, Ken. None. I mean, he's coaching with his coordinators, and I guarantee you he's saying a lot of things to his position coaches in the headset, but the interaction with players isn't there. And sometimes, you know, when you come out flat, like in that Oakland game in the first half, even if you're not necessarily a fiery guy, that's when you pick your spot and you get yourself into those position group meetings and timeouts and say, wake the fuck up. Like, start doing something here. And I don't see any of that, and I've watched for that, and so that concerns me, and that's just his style. The other thing is, offensively, I think, and again, this is before the last two games, I think his conservatism on the offensive side of the ball, he's hyper-aggressive on defense, which I like, but he was hyper-conservative on offense for a big stretch there, and I think DeFilippo has talked him out of it a few times, and in fact, I think the cameras cut to he and DeFilippo kind of arguing about a play call late in the game. DeFilippo was going at him a little bit. So that kind of conservatism, I've never liked that, and that's because that's all we've ever had. But hey, if they keep scoring 33 points a game, like I said, there's a long way to go. I think that can change. But I was really high on him last year, and I thought from a scheme standpoint, those first 11 games when we were 7-4, we were out-coaching the shit out of people, especially on offense, which was a lot of Kyle Shanahan. But you look at some of the throws Brian Hoyer had to make, they were wide open people. I mean, wide open. And we were out scheming, and we were out coaching, and defensively I thought we were doing well. And I just kind of thought between the training camp that he had, which I felt was lackadaisical and didn't really prepare us, to all of that, you know, just kind of basic play calling, he's kind of lost favor a little bit with me.
Well, I think with the conservatism on offense, I agree with him on it. I'm very conservative about it. So, he was catching some hell when he doesn't go for it on 4th-and-1, he punts. It's a 5-point game. It's still third quarter. His defense goes out and gives up a 90-yard drive, which then completely kills a point. But I would have punted too. I'm pretty conservative when it comes to the offensive side. I hate turnovers, especially with a team that's trying to, you know, if you're just playing out of nothing, then you can pull out all the stops, you can do whatever you want if that's the case, but if you're still trying to build confidence among that, you know, turnovers, especially on the offensive side, can kill you. I think now, because there is a little bit more confidence, maybe you see him open it up a little bit more, do a couple of different things. When scheme is thrown into there, especially on the offensive side, I think that John DeFilippo's done a great job. I think he's opened up Duke Johnson. I think he's opened up a couple of lanes for Isaiah Crowell that he needs to find. I thought the offensive line, even though they gave up 4 sacks, I thought they were much better against Baltimore than they've been in the past. And that was a unit that gave up 4 sacks. They were blitzing the hell out of them. They threw everything at him, and I thought they did a good job. You mentioned Kyle. Kyle's a great schemer. He's a great schemer. I thought he schemed very well to the talent he had last year. I don't know if he's the best talent evaluator. From some of the things I've heard and some of the guys who he's been excited about in the past, I don't know if he's the best talent evaluator, but I think he's schemed very well, and he is a good X's and O's coach. I still wonder about how cold he is. When it comes to sideline demeanor and talking to him, he works on that. There was he's a younger man at the time, but there was something that came out. There was a documentary that came out, and it resurfaced. It was an ESPN high school football thing. It resurfaced when he first got hired, and he is screaming to a point of where it got uncomfortable for me to actually watch it. Yeah. He's screaming at a high school kid. He can be, and I talk to him. I get a chance to actually speak to him a couple of times a week. He can be a very intense person. Very intense. And he's explained it before of when he's calm on the sidelines, he will boil on the inside, but he's trying to keep it calm and he's trying to keep it collected because he feels that affects his decision making. I agree with that. I think when you make decisions emotionally, players on the one hand, when you're playing defense, when you make read, react, decide emotionally, play tough, you know, that's a different thing. But when I got to make decisions and kind of not just make a decision there in that moment, but I got to think, if I do this, then A, B, C, D, E, F is going to happen or could happen. So I have to guard against all these things. I can't do that angry. I got to think, because if someone pissed me off before, and I'm screaming and yelling at somebody for jumping off sides, well, then I'm going to make a decision and I could double down on my problems. That's one of the things I think John Fox does. Yeah, John Fox will smile, John Fox will get mad. He's not the most overly animated guy, but he gets caught in the moment a lot, and he gets caught with his pants down a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it gets in his way. Tom Coughlin is that way. He's never been good with clock management. There's guys who, you know, Belichick's able to calculate it down to the second. He knows every single moment, every single situation, every single tick of the clock. He knows all that stuff. And when he does that, he's very cold on the sideline, very calculated on the sideline. The emotional stuff he leaves to that. I think that there's been kind of a push and pull, but I've seen him very intense. I've seen him, the first time I met him, he was extremely angry about something else, which was an awkward moment, and a story I'll tell to the cows come home about other things. And someday it'll all be done and I can tell that story, but man, it's one of the wildest I've ever seen. He was very angry about it, and I shook his hand, and I mean, blood was ready to shoot out his eyes. That's how angry he was. So I've seen him angry and intense, and I know he's capable of it. He does make a concerted effort, and he knows he gets criticized for it. But he is making a concerted effort to not show that much crazy emotion, to not be that angry. Because, I mean, hell, anything he does, he gets criticized for in that sideline. If he's not mad with everybody else, then it says that he doesn't care. These are all NFL head coaches. Pat Shurmur cared. They care.
Oh, he did.
They definitely care. Well, you know, so... I mean, they get criticized, but like when he smiles because a guy misses a field goal and the fist bump comes out, well, he's yelled at for smiling. There's nothing he's going to do. If you're not winning, there's nothing a coach is going to do on the sideline that's going to make you happy.
No, and
if you're screaming and yelling and you're losing to San Diego, people are just going to say you scream and yell and you lose to San Diego and you're not actually reaching your players. Ed Orgeron, who's a good position coach and a good recruiter, screamed his ass off when he was at Ole Miss, and his team sucked. And then he was looked at like an idiot because all he did was scream and yell. I mean, there's two sides to it. I couldn't help but be excited. I'm an emotional guy about that, but also I don't know if I could think my way out of a paper bag when it comes to making the decisions that he makes, or that he has to try to make.
Here's my thing on that real quick. I don't, you know, when I say that, I'm not necessarily talking about, okay, yeah, if a guy jumps off sides that you're going after him or you're getting in his face or, you know, but what I do think is there are times – as a coach, where you've got to notice that your team is flat, and you have a window there where, you know, it's not in front of everybody, but, you know, like I said, you walk back on that sideline to position groups, and you don't have to be animated about it, but you say, you know what, you better, let's get it going right now. And that's what I've watched for. To me, it's not as much the lack of emotion, and I was really happy, by the way, that he showed that emotion in Sunday's win. I mean, he showed a lot of emotion, which was fun. But at the same time, it's interaction with players. And I just don't see a lot of interacting. I see a lot of stuff with the coaches, and that's fine. And you can notice, especially the last two games, he's chewing out a lot of people on that headset a lot of the time, which is a good thing. It keeps your position coaches and your coordinators on their toes. But there's no interaction with the players other than that occasional, hey, fist bump, way to go, good job sort of thing. And, you know, that's the one thing, like, about Belichick. Everybody, you know, they make the Belichick comparison, and they say, hey, well, Bill Belichick, he doesn't do anything on the sideline. But if you watch Bill Belichick, and again, I've been fortunate enough to watch him up close in Buffalo, he is very, very, very involved with his players throughout the course of the game. You know, he'll go up and talk to somebody about, you know, something they did or didn't do or a stunt that they could run on the line or a different way to run the route or an adjustment with Tom Brady. That's kind of the hands-on stuff that I'm not seeing out of Pettine. I think that's what I want to be clear on when I say that with him. It's not that he just stands there, you know, and doesn't emote, but it's kind of more the interaction piece. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think... Again, I just don't think he can get it both ways. I need leadership. I need decision-making out of a guy who's tasked with doing that. So I need him to be able to do that. However, when you're losing, people see him on TV. They're pissed off. They want their coach to be pissed off. And a bunch of people think he doesn't care. I think that's – and I'm not saying you're saying that.
No, he definitely cares.
I'll get to the Belichick thing here in a minute. You're not saying that, and I'm not saying you're saying it, but I can't think of anything dumber than when I hear that.
Yeah,
I mean, I try to give a lot of people respect, but man, when I hear that come across, I'm like, God, this is just dumb. Of course, I mean, good God. The guy and this is where a lot of guys there's a lot of guys who make personal sacrifices to get an NFL paycheck to be an NFL head coach. He had it pretty damn good with it as a high school coach. He goes to be a video coordinator and then quality control, which is, you know, a whatever coaching job, basically a get back coach. Leaves high school to go to the NFL. I mean, could have been an athletic director, high school coach for the rest of his life, and everybody would have been fine, and people would have loved him. He probably would have ended up winning state championships, and that would have been the end of it. Leaves that to go do the NFL and go be a bottom feeder in the NFL when it comes to that coaching side. Worked his way through there. Has been divorced of it because when you have a lot of these guys make a decision whether it's going to be football or whether it's going to be their family, that's just the truth of it. So he's had to give up on that. Of course he cares. And again, I bring it up, you think of the worst head coaches in Browns history, or at least Browns history since 99. They all cared. They all cared with their lives. I mean, they all lived it and breathed it and tried to do everything that they could. But when you ultimately lose, you're ultimately hated in that position. And when you bring up Belichick, and I'm glad you brought him up like that, that's something that I don't think we give enough credit for. You know, Gerard says that. Because a lot of the stuff where we see him go out there and he has this very poor demeanor towards the media. He has a very poor demeanor towards a lot of other things. He looks very stoic, almost like a supervillain when he's on the sidelines. Javoris Allen, that's the other running back's name. Sorry, off my head. He still talks to his players a lot more than what we give him credit to do that. He is still very much more involved, and he's a lot more intense behind the scenes. Gerard would always say that, is that you don't see the way his players see him. You don't see him the way that a lot of guys around him see him every single day, where he's extremely involved, extremely intense on a lot of these certain things, but we just don't see it on the sideline for 3 hours once a week, because that's basically when you see the man. You see him during a football game, and you see him in a press conference, and you see him talk and go out there with a straight-ass face, because he's almost a sociopath with how good of an actor you got to be as an NFL head coach, and talk about holding balls and people making dick jokes at you and saying all these things, and he does it with a straight face. And you just go, good God, that's scary with how in control of your own emotions and how in control of your own message you can be. As a head coach, because there's a lot of guys who talk and they get themselves in trouble, and then he just says exactly what he wants to say or exactly what he wants to tell you, and then he'll clam up, and you're not going to get anything out of him.
Well, hey, listen, this has been fun. I want to throw a couple of quick questions at you while we have your time. And again, Ken is the busiest guy also in Cleveland. He's doing everything, so to take the time to do this, I really appreciate it, and I hope the people that are listening enjoy it. But I want to ask you something that it just came up in my head, and I don't know how the hell I got this in my head with what we're talking about, but it's something, one of the rare things about Cleveland sports that you and I haven't talked about over the last couple of years, I'm going to throw you a curveball. It's an Indians question. Are you a fan, and let me rephrase that because I don't want to make it as black and white. Are you okay with Paul Dolan or the Dolan family as owners of the Indians, or do you think something needs to be done? And I'm not even going to interject my opinion. I've never asked you this before. Are you okay with the Dolans?
I am. And a lot of people hate me for saying that. I'm so absolutely scared of somebody else owning the baseball team. I wish I could just get the message to them. I get very nervous about it. Because they're still Cleveland people, they still want to keep the team in Cleveland. They don't do a good job running that baseball team. I'm not saying that they do a good job. That's not a defense of how they run it. I just wish they'd run it differently and maybe run it a little bit more towards getting guys, or at least trying to do it. And they're trying to do it right. This is a long answer, actually, because I can see in some of the reasoning that they're doing. And you see the Mets try to do this. The Astros are trying to do this. Kansas City already did it. This goes back to John Hart, Adam. Is that you get out in front of guys, you sign them to contracts, you don't let them become free agents. Because there will be a guy like a Trout who will be a free agent who will command the first $400 million contract.
Sure.
That's one. There's a lot of guys that you need other than a Mike Trout to do well. And Mike Trout's a guy who hasn't tasted the playoffs in a couple of years now. So for a lot of baseball guys, and I think they're doing it the right way. I really do. Is that they get it? They get out in front of guys before they do it because they know that they want security. So they sign guys to contracts that give them security. They sign guys to contracts that give them some financial leeway to make some other moves, and it gives them an opportunity to do some things. I think that's really the new way of doing baseball. That's really the new way of working in baseball and getting guys to sign with you. The days I think of, there will still be major free agent signings. There will still be that every now and then. But I think that arms race, like we've seen in the past with Boston and New York and even the Dodgers, you know, the Dodgers have signed their own guys. A lot of those guys are their own guys. They've just signed them to massive contracts to make sure that they stay with the LA Dodgers. And I think that's what a lot of guys are doing. They're trying to get out ahead of this curve. They're trying to get them in there and keep them on their baseball team. I think the Indians are trying to do it, but there's a couple of times where, you know, a right-hand bat, trading for a right-hand bat couldn't be more right in your freaking face than anything else. I think that there's been some complacency, certainly, with the ownership, but still, I become very, very, very nervous anytime anybody's going to own a baseball, football, basketball team that I love. And I truly, sometimes I absolutely hate their guts, just like there's times I hate the Browns with a deep passion, and yep. I hate the Cavs with a deep passion. But we hate our brothers, we hate our sisters, we hate our fathers, we hate our mothers, we hate our wives, we hate our lives at times. But we love all those people. So I get very nervous because they're doing something with something we love that we have no control over, and that's a very scary thought. So while I've vehemently disapproved with the Dolans at times, I'm still very nervous about new ownership because there's always going to be loopholes, there's always going to be wranglings and legal wranglings and leases that things can change. I mean, contracts are meant to be broken, and contracts even with cities are meant to be broken. So that's something I take very serious and seriously, and something I get very nervous about. Even though Paul Dolan isn't the perfect owner, not by a long shot, I still wonder about somebody new coming in. People hated Randy Lerner. Randy Lerner paid a bunch of people a bunch of money to go away, and he paid a lot of people who lied to his face saying that they had what he needed to have a good football team. Randy Lerner wanted to have a good football team. He just didn't know how to do it. And a lot of people were rejoicing when Jimmy Haslam took over.
I liked Randy. I really did. I liked Randy.
I thought that there were times where he needed to be a little bit more open and a little bit more out there, but I think that a lot of people turned and hated his guts because he spent a ton of money with the best of intentions, but if you're the owner, just like the fans, you're going to be the one left holding the bag, but you're the one still spending the money. You're spending their money in their own eyes, so you're going to take that criticism, and he took that criticism, and I warn people a million times over, is I know you're feeling good right now, but you better be careful. You better be careful with these guys, because any new owner is a whole new set of scary problems, and so far, I think that Jimmy does really want to win. I don't know if he knows how to win. I think he's gotten in his own way. I think that some of the things that have happened to Lerner have started to happen to him a little bit with some of the other general managers and people working around him and the power he's given to some of those folks. You know, Dan Gilbert is a guy who's a bull in a china shop and is going to do things his way and knows good business and knows that he had to make a business decision in apologizing to LeBron to bring LeBron back. That was a man who swallowed his hat because you're not going to ever get a billionaire to apologize to you. So I thought that that was one of the most selfless and best business decisions I've ever seen, just observing owners. Because 99% of owners, and they can tell you whatever they want, there's a couple of guys who will do what they can for players. You know, Arthur Blank rolling out Michael Vick in his wheelchair and stuff like that before Michael Vick had the dog situation happen to him. But most owners, if a player, even the best player, challenges him, most of those owners will tell them to F off. They've made their money the hard way, a lot of those guys, or they've made strong business decisions before. They've bought and sold lives, literally lives. They've ended lives in their past. They've done some things that we might consider certainly greasy. So if a player, a guy who he's paying, he's still on his payroll, decides that he's going to say something to him or try to hold him over, you're going to get a very firm bleep you from 99% of the owners. And I do think that there are owners in the NBA, I think there's owners in professional sports that if they own the Cavaliers, they would have continued to say bleep you to LeBron.
Oh, I agree.
They wouldn't have written a letter now, but they would have continued to say bleep you, and back channels would not have apologized, would not have reached out. It did take some understanding, took business acumen, because you know LeBron's going to make you a hell of a lot of money, but it took some real stones to go down and apologize to a guy where LeBron makes a ton of money, but will never, ever, ever be on the same wavelength as Dan Gilbert as far as actual wealth. That takes a lot. So that's something, you know, that team, after LeBron's gone, that team will be a dumpster fire. But that's something I would commend Dan Gilbert on, and I think that's, if you have an owner who's willing to do that, the jury's always going to be out on owners, but that's a damn good owner right there. That's something that's good. And I think, you know, I think that Jimmy has the best of intentions. I think Paul has the best of intentions. I just think two of them go about it the wrong way. The third one was going about it the wrong way, but got bailed out by LeBron with talent. And we'll see what he does after LeBron actually hangs him up.
Here's my thing about the Dolans, and I have a friend who he and I talk about this quite a bit. He likes the Dolans. Well, I shouldn't say likes the Dolans. He tolerates the Dolans. And, you know, you made a lot of good points about Paul and the fact of they're building it the right way in theory. But what we haven't done that all of those other teams have done, and specifically the Royals, you know, they built a really good core, right? And they got those guys to commit long-term to Kansas City. But when they identified that they had a core that they felt, you know what, with this core we can win the World Series, they went out and supplemented that core. They paid the extra amount of money to get them over the hump. I went to Minneapolis this summer and I watched the Twins, and I talked to somebody who's in Minnesota's front office, and I had no idea of the answer to this. I just casually asked, you know, what's your payroll? And they're over $100 million, and they're in that rebuilding phase right now where they're trying to build it the right way, and they had a lot more success this year than a lot of us thought they would. But here we are, and in my opinion, we have a core, right? We've got a good group of players. We've got a phenomenal pitching staff. We've got a lot of talent here, but the constraints that Paul Dolan puts on the payroll, even though we have that core, the fact that he can't identify and say, look, I know I'm going to take a loss for 2 or 3 years, but fuck it, let's do it. Let's try to win a World Series. And I just think if he give that investment once, just once, then all of a sudden you're going to see attendance improve. You're going to see the mood toward the Indians from the fans drastically improve, because we both know Cleveland fans are really smart. And my personal theory on being a fan or with other fans is that a fan will have an owner's back, like me with Randy Lerner. Was Randy Lerner a good owner? No. But God damn it, he tried. He really tried. And he spent his money to try. And I respect that. Dan Gilbert, exactly what you just said. You know what? He did what he had to do to bring back the best player in the world. Jimmy Haslam, I don't think he's spending as much money as he could. But Paul Dolan, he refuses to spend his money, and he's more interested, in my opinion, in making a profit than winning the World Series. And like for me, you know, I used to go to a lot of Indians games. I grew up, I was a teenager in that span of the 90s where we had great teams. I mean, that's what I grew up with. The Browns were gone, and I loved the Indians. I loved them, and I still do love them, but I don't go to as many games. Like my dad and I, we don't go to as many games now as we did back then. And it's not, you know, the casual fan will say, well, that's because the team's been worse. Not really. I mean, back then we were invested because we had a team that was invested, and we genuinely felt like we had a shot. Now, I don't feel like we have an owner that gives us a shot or at least cares about, you know, World Series victories. I think that the majority of the fan base believes that he's okay with mediocrity, with 500, with, hey, let's just, you know, try to do the best that we can, and if we steal a few, we steal a few, and let's see what we can do if we get into the playoffs. I want an owner that's going to spend his money to win a World Series, and even if it's within a window.
You think about this. Kansas City, I think, has snowballed a lot of people. I can't see where they've brought in tremendous free agents, tremendous. I mean, they've had guys pan out for them so far, but I haven't seen them throw out a great big contract or get a great big contract signed. I think they offered something to David Price to make it look good, but they've built meticulously through there, and then they've traded during seasons to help out their team. See, that's the difference.
They've taken on more payroll.
Yeah. Are you willing to go for the gusto in that time? Are you willing to negotiate with a team that's trying to get rid of a player, can I get that number down and have you share some of this to make this guy go away? But I know that I'm going to take on that payroll for the rest of the year. However, I'm going to incur a great big risk because I know that this guy can leave very shortly, just like what happened with David Price. I think you're right about that to that degree. But again, they've done what a lot of teams are trying to do. Get out in front, sign guys who are going to be pillars for their team long term, but make it something that gives them security, the player security, but also gives the team security and gives the team a little bit of leeway. And Kansas City, I think, is the perfect example as well, because the Glass family was hated down there for a very long period of time since they've owned that baseball team. And just now are kind of getting in the good graces. With Jimmy right now, I mean, hell, I'll be honest with you, I'm more than happy with him letting his money sit in the bank if you got a general manager who's going to go out and give $9 million guaranteed to Dwayne.
That's true.
I mean, that money's honestly doing me more good just sitting there in the bank for somebody else to use it, or for maybe Ray to use it wiser, more wisely than what he's doing right now with some of these contracts being handed out. Because you hear about players and you hear about guys they're chasing, and I just wonder, gosh, would I rather have Tremont Williams and Pernell McPhee than Tremont Williams, Randy Starks, Dwayne Bowe, Brian Hartline? You know, would I rather have that? Because I'm not really using Brian Hartline to begin with. My wide receiver core is still going to need replacement. Tremont Williams, I think, has done a very solid job and has been worth the money so far this year, and they gave him a lot of money. But I think he's been at least as close to worth it as you're going to see it. And I know that they were in the running for Pernell McPhee, and that price tag was a steep price tag. All right, well, am I making a bigger impact on my team at outside linebacker with a guy like Pernell McPhee, or am I making a bigger impact on my team with a guy in sweatpants on the sideline every day who's a healthy scratch? Randy Starks has provided something, but has been really a guy. Tremont Williams, again, who's been good. And then, you know, Brian Hartline, who... I want to see him do well, obviously, but really hasn't been able to give you a whole bunch so far. You know, I wonder about what happens there. That's all.
All right.
But they did make a great move with Andy Lee.
Yeah. Great move. Thank goodness for him. Last thing I want to ask you before I let you go, and again, we really appreciate you taking the time. And this is the kind of guy that Ken is. I ask for 10 minutes, and he's willing to give an hour. And that's just, if you know Ken, and I'm saying this not because he's on with us right now. I'll say it because people in Cleveland need to know it. There are a lot of people in Cleveland media, and I won't mention any names. There are a lot of dicks in Cleveland media. Ken is genuinely one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. I'm just a great guy. He cares about the fans. He wants to do a good job with anything that he does. He wants that fan interaction. Just a great guy, and evidenced is right now. He's taken an hour to talk with us here. But the last thing I want to ask you, Ken, is with Tristan Thompson, because I've actually normally, and Ken has followed me for a long time on Twitter, and so he kind of knows that I can get emotional from time to time with Cleveland sports, and typically I tend to fall in line with what the majority of fans are thinking most of the time, but I'm really taking a step out of the box and trying to calm people down about Tristan Thompson. And I said this on our podcast last week. Mike Arnold, who's one of our co-hosts, he's a big Cavs fan, a basketball nerd. You know, he's not a big Thompson guy and thinks he's asking for too much. And of course he is asking for too much, but here's my take, and I want to get yours. If you look at the amount of max contracts that have been given out this year in the NBA to some really bad players, it's staggering. Like, if you look at the list of players who've received max contracts this year, you wouldn't look at, you know, 50% of them and say that they deserve it, number one. Number two, you know, the salary cap's about to explode. A lot of people hold this personally against Tristan Thompson, the fact that he's holding out, the fact that he may miss time going into the season because of all of this. I'm not that upset with Tristan. I understand where he's coming from, but even more, and this is where I'm coming from, I appreciate the value that he brings, and he's never going to light up the stat sheet, and he's a liability from the free throw line, and he's not a jump shooter, but the things that he does, and he does really well, the defensive rebounding, okay, he's a good defender, he really is. You know, what he can do inside in terms of wearing out guys, you know, opposition players in the front court, he is so valuable to a basketball team. Is he a max player? Hell no, he's not a max player. But I know why he's asking for a lot of money, and I guarantee you, Ken, that David Blatt right now is telling David Griffin and Dan Gilbert, look, I know you've spent a lot of money, and thank you, but for what it's worth, get this done with Tristan because we need him. We really do need him. I still maintain, Ken, and I don't know your thoughts, I think other than LeBron, he was the best player for us on the floor in the finals and even in the Eastern Conference Finals, if you from an overall game perspective. So a lot of people are jumping off the cliff with Tristan right now and disowning him as a Cleveland guy. I think he's a great locker room guy. I don't think he wants to hurt the team. I think he wants what's best for him, and I think he does have genuine value in the NBA.
I think he wants his money, and I think that he's got a real bulldog on the edge of idiot as an agent.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just wonder about what's your market now. You know, you got your own. Well, first of all, you get your own player, get your own teammate. Kevin disagreed with me on this, but there was a lot of people disagreed with me on this. LeBron is able to talk about it, and LeBron is the one guy who's powerful enough to talk about other players' contracts, to call them distractions,
sure
to say that they need to do this. LeBron's a daddy, and if people don't like it, that's the NBA with LeBron in it. I don't know what else to say. There's some other guy who's 15 years old right now, and he'll be able to do it someday. But that's LeBron's way, and that's the way LeBron has been doing it, and will continue to do it. So when he says it, I think a lot of people listen. For Tristan, what I get so upset about, I don't get upset with him for trying to get his money. Get your paper, okay? You're doing something for a very short period of time. Go get your money. I don't have a problem with that. I do have a problem, though, where it almost seems that you're doing this at your own risk. You know that you don't have... He goes anywhere else, he's not a viable player. And he goes anywhere else, they're not going to pay him. They're going to overpay him. Whoever pays him is going to overpay him. The Cavs are going to massively overpay him. But whoever else were to pay him, they're going to overpay him. You're exactly right about this. And there's been a couple of... I've been kind of happier about this to the league just because maybe guys are getting finally what they're maybe worth. J.R. Smith bet on it. J.R. Smith lost. Other guys have lost. For crying out loud, I almost said a cuss word there. Jeremy Lin got $25 million, for Christ's sake. Omar Asik has made millions of dollars to bitch and moan on benches in the NBA.
Yeah.
I mean, Omar Asik, for Christ's sake, gets extensions, gets $25, $30 million contracts, then gets another big contract. You go, what do you actually bring? You're on the Rockets, and all you did was bitch. Stop bitching and play. And he's one of the guys, and that's just one of the players in the NBA who do that. For Tristan, he's going to get paid an ass load of money. All right, that's there. That's what's going to happen. So he gets paid his ass load of money. Well, you're going to get an ass load of money. You get an ass load of money in Cleveland, you get a real ass load of it. So I have all this money in Cleveland. I'm still playing with LeBron. So while there's going to be more expected of me, it's still less expected of me.
Exactly.
So that's a good situation.
Yep.
I make more money in Cleveland than I ever make for anywhere else. I have a chance in Cleveland where I wouldn't have a chance in Toronto. I would not have a real chance in Portland. Let's be honest about those two destinations. There's no real chance with either one of those places. This doesn't make sense anymore. And if he actually sits out, you only hurt your own... You only hurt your own brand. You only hurt your own chances. Because if you become a free agent, say he comes back halfway through the year and gets hurt. First of all, you've killed your security. I think you've killed what other chances you can to even get that big of a contract somewhere else. I know that there's TV money that gets involved in this. Yeah. I get that. But there's also something to be said for security. There's also something to be said for, you know what, you were a $53 million player before the finals. You proved in one series, and he was really good in that series. They asked him to extend himself. He did that against Chicago as well. They asked him to extend his role in the postseason. He extended his role. He played very, very well. I'll never take that away from Tristan. He played very well. He played well enough to take $53 million and turn it into $80, and then showed great balls to ask for a full max at $94 million. So you're asking for $14 million on top of that. I mean, $94, if I just do it, minus $53, for Christ's sake. That's, $41 million extra?
Yep.
$41 million over a postseason? Are you kidding me?
And not counting the luxury tax bill that Dan Gilbert would have to pay for that $41 million? I mean, escalate that times three or four.
So, I just think in a lot of ways that, hey, just, you know what, get the damn thing signed.
It's Rich Paul.
Okay, it's not, I mean, you're still looking at $27 million extra on the postseason. I think you need to get this signed. I think they will get it signed. I really can't imagine it going too long because I think he just hurts himself. He keeps talking about, well, I'll take the qualifying offer and then I'll leave. What, are you going to leave out of spite? All right, because, again, all this goes away. All these chances to do things go away. I remember being upset about Trevor Ariza leaving L.A. when the Lakers were really good and heading out to Houston. And Ariza's been a good player. But is it worth more to you? Is it worth more to you to be the number four guy? This is amazing. The number four, number five guy in L.A. than it is to be the number one guy in Houston? Because Ariza's always been a good player. He hasn't really been heard of since. Okay? And for Tristan, if you're the fourth guy in Cleveland, you going to really go be the number one in Toronto?
Yeah, that's not going to
really
work out.
Be the number two in Toronto? And if you go to Portland, you'll be the number two in Portland, and you're not going to – you might win a playoff series in Toronto. You might win a playoff series in Portland. Great. You know, wonderful. And you're still not getting paid as much money as you would in Cleveland. So it just – we're getting to a point now where he's – as it's gone longer, he's shrunk his own market. Or Rich Paul has shrunk his client's own market. And then I think he's shrunk his client's own earning power here. That's – those are two things that I think an agent, and I wonder how much of this is, because we're always going to blame the player. We know the player. Not a lot of people know who Rich Paul is, or know Rich Paul as much as they do of Tristan. So we say Tristan, but I wonder where the agent's head is on this.
That's where it is. And look, I've had the privilege of meeting Tristan. He's one of the nicest athletes I've met. And so, you know, to me, looking at this from the outside, looking in, it looks as if this is the LeBron leverage game. LeBron and Rich and Maverick Carter and their team, you know, they think that they can get the Cavs to do whatever they want and help Tristan out in the process. And if they just hold out a little longer and for a little more money and just a little longer, and that's why, I mean, look, passive aggressively, LeBron sends out that photo with him and Tristan and get it done. And, you know, his team sends out that photo. And then Tristan sends out, and it just becomes this game where, you know, LeBron is very involved with Rich Paul and what goes on with that agency. And so I think that game's being played as well. But
I think LeBron's trying to make himself better as time goes on. He wants to be a businessman, and there's a lot of things that are business. And I've had to learn this, you know, myself, is to try not to take it personally, that a lot of things that happen in a professional setting happen with business. And I think a lot of us have to do that in our lives. And I think LeBron has had to do that, obviously, at a much larger scale than any of us will ever touch. So for him, I think he's doing his best to recuse himself emotionally from some of this. And emotionally from conversations. And from conversations about what they're going to do with contracts. And what they're going to do with this. And now, if Tristan's not on the floor, this is still an emotional thing to this degree, and you can disagree with this, and I can understand you would. But if Tristan's not on the floor, that still affects LeBron's business. LeBron's business is winning championships.
No, I agree with that.
You only improve your brand as a champion. My God, it goes without saying. People want to be around winners. They want to be around champions. You make money being a champion. Everybody makes money being a champion. And there's guys doing commercials out in Seattle for car dealerships who have no business doing it because they're on championship football.
I agree with that. Yep.
So it's better for everybody when you win. And I think he sees that, and that's part of the reason that I still think that LeBron, there's definitely an instinct to want to win. There's a passion for the game. There's all those things. But there's also knowing that, hey, man, when you're a champion, when you've won it, your brand is spectacular. And you got to get back to that level because you want to be known as one of the all times. You want to be known as one of the greats, and it only helps out. It only helps you out in the future to win as many of those rings as you can before you have to finish.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Ken Carman, the first ever guest, and easily the best guest we'll ever have on the Hard Foul Sports Cleveland podcast. Ken, thanks again for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, you bastard.
Ken Carman, everybody, the best that Cleveland has to offer when it comes to sports radio. Again, just a great guy. And you hear for yourself his insight. Again, you can find Ken on the morning show on 92.3, The Fan with Kevin Kiley, every Monday through Friday, and all along the Cleveland Browns radio network with coverage on game days, and of course the Mike Pettine show throughout the week, and nationally on CBS Sports Radio every Sunday night from 10 to 2. Really happy to have Ken along, and again, appreciate him helping us out here at Hard Foul Sports Cleveland. We'll be back with our next edition of the Hard Foul Sports Cleveland podcast later in the week. And until then, we'll see you at HFS Cleveland on Twitter or hardfoulsports.com.